in our study of the miracles of Jesus Christ. And we'll be dealing with the healing of the man with the withered hand, looking primarily at Matthew's account of this, but also at some of the other accounts. Matthew's account is found in Matthew chapter 12. I want to spend just a couple of minutes reviewing some of the key concepts. I know I do this a lot, but sometimes we have visitors or people who haven't been able to be in the class regularly, so we want to make sure everybody's on sort of the same page of what we're doing. And we want to be reminded that as we're studying the miracles of Christ, we are studying events that verify the identity of Christ and also reveal to us very important aspects of His character. So we're learning not only who He is, but something about His person, something about His character, and also then lessons that He wants us to be able to learn and apply for our lives as well. So there's an awful lot to be learned from the miracles of Christ. If you look at Matthew 11, just backing up a chapter from where our miracle is from this morning, Matthew 11 in verse 1, it came to pass when Jesus finished commanding His 12 disciples, He departed to teach and preach in their cities. And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ, he sent two of His disciples and said to him, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and tell John the things which you hear and see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me." The very primary thing that Jesus is telling John's disciples to go back and tell him is, look at what I'm doing. Look at the miracles that are being performed. This testifies as to who I am. John says, "Are you the coming one?" Jesus says, "The answer to that question is really seen in my deeds, in my works, in performing these miracles." And even today, as we ask that question, is Jesus the Son of God? Is He the Messiah of the Old Testament? Is He the coming one? The answer to that is seen in His miracles. And that's why it's so vital that we study these. Many other signs did Jesus in the presence of His disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in His name. So this is the vital importance of studying miracles. Jesus' ability and authority to perform divine miracles on the Sabbath is a critical point in this study. We brought it up in a couple of lessons already, and I'm really going to hone in on it, Lord willing, in today's lesson. If Jesus is the coming one, if He is the Son of God and the Messiah, then He is the Lord of the Sabbath. He, as God, has to continue to work on the Sabbath, as we saw in Wednesday night's lesson. God can't really stop being God, or the world falls apart, as we said at the end of the lesson on Wednesday night. And so this is a very vital point in understanding who Jesus is. And He brings this to the forefront of people's minds by purposely performing miracles on the Sabbath day and causing the Jews to raise their eyebrows and ask the questions. And of course, some people would be prejudiced against Him for doing this. Other people then would consider that, wow, if He's performing divine works, works of God on this day, He must be God. And many people came to that conclusion as well. That's what He was really trying to draw out of men. So we saw in John 5 last Wednesday night in that lesson that that Jesus healed the lame man on the Sabbath. "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And so the Jews were angry that Christ performed that on the Sabbath day, and they sought how they might take Him. In John chapter 9 and verse 14, all of John chapter 9 is about the healing of a blind man. But in verse 14, we learn that he was healed on the Sabbath, and this especially aggravated the Jews on that occasion. In Luke chapter 14, you have a man who's healed of dropsy on the Sabbath, very similar to the miracle that we're studying today, where Jesus heals the man with the withered hand. And then in Luke chapter 13, you have a woman with an infirmity who's healed on the Sabbath. And I'd like to look at that briefly with you even before we get into our miracle today, just to see some of the points that are made in Luke chapter 13. Look at, again, he's in the synagogues teaching in Luke 13 and verse 10. There's a woman who had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years. Jesus heals her of this infirmity. In verse 14, the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. And he said to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath day." And so this ruler of the synagogue is expressing the common concept of the leadership of the Jews. Here's a miracle that's done on the Sabbath day. They overlook the fact that it's a miracle, that it's divine power, and they focus on that it's a work, and so you can't do that on the Sabbath day. And that's all they can see. They can't see the divine nature of the work. And so here's what the man's objection is. Jesus answered him, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it? So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath?" So here again, Jesus will be teaching in the miracle we study today of the man with the withered hand some of these very same principles to illustrate that he is indeed God in the flesh. Well, let's go back to Matthew chapter 12. I said that's where we would be, and that's where we need to really launch forth this morning. And in order to really put ourselves in the place of the people who witnessed this miracle and understand it in its context, you almost have to, before you start looking at the miracle in Matthew 12 and verse 9, back up to Matthew 12 and verse 1 and see that it was the issue of Sabbath keeping that really brought Jesus to a point of performing this miracle on the Sabbath and causing people to ask the questions that they asked. So let's back up to Matthew 12 as we consider the background to this miracle. First of all, Jesus is going through the grain fields with His disciples on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pluck the heads of grain. I've often wondered about doing that in modern times. I don't know what the law exactly is in our times, but first of all, if you're walking through somebody else's field, you're liable to get shot for trespassing, I guess. But if you wanted to just walk out in somebody's field, like after the cotton harvest, and have your kids learn how to, you know, pick the gleanings of the cotton or something like that, I wonder if that would be okay. I guess it would. But in Jewish times, the law was actually given by God that if you were passing through a neighbor's field and it was the harvest time and you wanted to pick some grain, you were welcome to do that, just to pluck some grain and eat it as you went along. Now, you couldn't take, you know, you couldn't take a sickle or some sort of harvesting instrument and a bag through the field with you. You couldn't do that, but as you went through the field, you could grab some grain and sort of eat it as you went. That law is found in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 25. So what they were doing was perfectly lawful to do in Jewish society. The question that they raise is, it's not lawful to do it on the Sabbath day. Okay? Well, if you think about that, why wouldn't it be lawful to do it on the Sabbath day, what they were doing? Could you walk on the Sabbath day? Could you eat on the Sabbath day? So they were walking and they were eating. And the only thing that you could say anything about was that they happened to be reaching out their hands to a head of grain and taking that and putting it in their mouths. Well, that's not any different than taking something out of a bowl and putting it in your mouth, right? So in reality, Jesus' disciples were not doing anything that was unlawful. I think that is very, very important to understand in this text. I have a lot of folks that I've talked to over the years, even some friends of mine, who've tried to use this text to say, okay, you have a law of God, you know, if the certain situation dictates it, you can just ignore the law of God. Have y'all known people to use or misuse this text in that way, just to say, you know, at certain times it's okay to ignore God's law? That is the last thing that Jesus is teaching in this context, all the way through the rest of this miracle. That's the last thing that he's teaching. He's not, I mean, by that I mean he's not teaching that at all. That's not what this text teaches. The disciples didn't break the law. In fact, later on, he tells, in verse 7, he tells the Jews who object, he says, "If you known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the," what? Guiltless. They're guiltless. They didn't break the law. They're not guilty of breaking the Sabbath law. That's what Jesus says. Jesus doesn't, he's not saying in any of this, he's not saying, well, it's okay, you should let them slide by because they're hungry or this or that. He's saying they didn't break the law. They didn't break the law. So, the objection of the Pharisees in verse 2 is completely inaccurate. And I think that's something that's very, very important to understand. The Pharisees charged them with breaking the law. Of course, the Pharisees were actually more concerned about judging people who had violated their traditions. Now, their tradition was that you weren't supposed to do that. But it was just a Pharisaic tradition. You weren't supposed to go through the fields and pluck the grain on the Sabbath. So, that's really what they're concerned about. Matthew 7, Jesus condemns them for setting themselves up as judges based on their hypocritical traditions. So in this text, if we go read Matthew 12 now, look at verse 3. He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests?" Now, do y'all remember that story in the Old Testament? Everybody go over to, hold your finger there in Matthew 12. Let's go over to 1 Samuel 21. 1 Samuel 21. And look at that story with me. David comes to Nob. Ahimelech is the priest. Ahimelech was afraid when he met David. David's running from Saul, basically, on this occasion, as he did for quite a while. David said to Ahimelech, the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you, and I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me the loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found.' And the priest answered and said to David, 'There is no common bread on hand, but that which is holy bread. If the young men have it, at least keep themselves from women.' David answered and said to the priest, 'Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. The vessels of the young men are holy. The bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day.' So the priest gave him holy bread. And there was no bread there but the show bread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away." So there's the event that Jesus is referring to. Let me ask you something. Does anybody see something in that text that David did that was not right? There's at least two things. One was he told a fib. Okay? And the other one was that he ate of the bread, which was not lawful to eat. Jesus says it's not lawful to eat of that bread. Now, Jesus is not saying in Matthew 12, there, you know, that's okay. You know, that neither one of those things was sin. That's not what Jesus is saying. People a lot of times look back at the Old Testament and they say, well, you know, David told a lie here or Abraham told a lie there, and therefore lying's okay on some occasions. No. Just because the Bible tells that history doesn't mean it's justifying people who did things that were wrong. Sometimes it just tells history as history, doesn't go into the details of the morality of the things that people did. But the point is, back to Matthew 12, well, what is the point? What is Jesus saying? You think any of these Jewish leaders would have said, well, you know what? That David is just going to hell because he ate the showbread. It's not lawful to do that. He violated the law of God. Therefore, you think any of the Jewish leaders are saying that kind of stuff? No. David very plainly violated. That's what the text says. Very, very plainly did that which was not lawful to do. These Jews aren't condemning him. Yet, Jesus' disciples are walking through a grain field picking grain, which is lawful to do, and they condemn his disciples. What's Jesus really pointing out? Hypocrisy. He's pointing out hypocrisy. That's where this text is going. And then, Jesus says, well, what about the priests on the Sabbath? Have you not read in the law? Both of these he introduces by asking the question, have you not read? So many times, folks, when people are mistaken about spiritual truths, the real problem is they haven't read. They really don't know what the text of Scripture says. And Jesus introduces both of these scenarios from the Old Testament by saying, have you not read? Have you not read? But he says, have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? What did the priest have to do in the temple on the Sabbath day? Every Sabbath day they had to do something. They had to sacrifice at least two animals. You think there's any work involved in that? Yeah. So that goes on every Sabbath day. And normally, of course, that, you know, killing and burning an animal, there's a lot of work involved in that. Normally that would not be something you could do, but on the Sabbath they had to do that. So there are things, even though the Sabbath basic law was not to work, God Himself had said there were things that you could do and should do on the Sabbath day. And so Jesus is pointing that out to them. First, their hypocrisy. Secondly, that they really don't understand the Sabbath law and what it's all about. They're ignorant about that. And mainly, Jesus wants them to see a couple of things. First of all, what does God really want? He says, if you'd understood what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. That's a quotation from Hosea 6 and verse 6. What does God really want of His worshipers? Anybody? What does He want? He wants obedience. He wants obedience. Does He want more concern with doing the right thing or more concerned with what's in the heart? Well, He really wants, that's an illegitimate question, He really wants both. But if you had to choose between what would be more important to Him, the mercy, the what's in the heart, comes first. Just doing something that may or may not be correct, that maybe is correct, but your heart's not in it, that's not getting you anywhere. So your heart's got to be in the right place first, and then we go to, let's do the right thing in the right way as well. But it's got to start with what's in your heart. The same is true with worship today. It has to start with what's in your heart. And if your heart isn't right, no matter what you do, it's not going to be right. And so that's the starting place. And so the text of Hosea 6:6, I believe Jesus is applying here to basically say there's a priority of things. And the priority is get your heart right and then worship God right. Now, when we get into the miracle here, and we will get there just in a moment, when we get into the miracle, we will see that the problem with the Jewish leaders was, guess where? In their heart. Okay? It was in their heart. So that's going to be besides the implications of the miracle itself, maybe the biggest lesson that we'll be able to get out of our study today is, what's in your heart? What's in your heart as you go before God? You'll have questions or thoughts about the text leading up to the miracle there in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8. I didn't mention the other point that Jesus makes here. He says, you know, God desires mercy and not sacrifice. But the other thing is, what position is Jesus in? Somebody said it, Lord of the Sabbath. Now, Jesus isn't saying, and again, I think this text has been grossly misused, there are those who would say, well, Jesus is saying, you know, after all, He's Lord, He can make up the rules as He goes along, He can do whatever He wants to, and if He wants to change the rule to suit Himself, He can do that. You think that's what Jesus is saying? I don't believe so. I think He's saying, I'm in position, who really made the Sabbath? Who made the Sabbath laws? Who knows more about the Sabbath than anybody? Well, Jesus. He's Lord of the Sabbath. And for anybody, any human being, to try to tell Jesus what He ought to do and ought not to do on the Sabbath is just really ridiculous. He is the Lord of the Sabbath. You see? So that He's saying His position, He's not saying, I'm justified because I'm Lord, I can do anything I want. He's saying, I'm justified because I made this. I did. I know what this is all about. far more than anybody else does. I'm in charge of it. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. It's really what he's saying. And so I think those two points, and that point is really a claim of Jesus for his deity. All right, let's move on and sure enough look at the details of the miracle itself. Let me read it from Matthew's account. We'll look some into Mark and Luke's account as well. Matthew 12, verse 9. When they had departed from there, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" That they might accuse him. And he said to them, "What man is there among you who has one sheep? If it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him. So you see, it was this very point, probably more than anything else, to start with the last first. It was this very point of healing on the Sabbath, repeatedly doing these things on the Sabbath, that got the Pharisees and leaders of the Jews so incensed against Christ that they would eventually destroy him. This was the thing over and over again that stuck in their craw, and that they refused to see the significance of him being able to perform divine miracles on the Sabbath. Well, just to review then what we read and emphasize, I think, some of the points that need looking at. Luke's account says that this was on another Sabbath. So Jesus doesn't have this confrontation with the Pharisees on one day and then just immediately enter a synagogue and heal the man with the withered hand. But there is a connection that's made between the two events. And I'm sure this Sabbath day where he healed the withered hand was very near in time to the same Sabbath day where the disciples had plucked the grain and they'd had this controversy. It might be worthwhile to note that in Matthew's account, Matthew's the only one that says it this way, he says he went into their synagogue. That plural pronoun there, who's that referring back to in Matthew's account? Well, the hypocritical Pharisees that we just talked about, right? The ones who questioned. So it was their synagogue, maybe a synagogue where some of these same Pharisees who'd had this objection about the disciples plucking the grain, maybe the same synagogue where some of them were. So, he goes into a synagogue, one of their synagogues, a synagogue where Pharisees were. And there's a man there with a withered hand. Was this a setup? There were situations, I know for sure, where there were setups, you know, to see what Jesus would do. Questions would be asked, or people that needed healing to see what Jesus would do. It's not spelled out on this occasion, but it very well could be. They asked, in Matthew's account, they asked the question. In Luke's account, it says they watch him closely. They're looking for a reason to accuse him of something. The text also tells us. They're looking for a reason to accuse him of something. So, have you found, let's just get back to a little bit to human nature. If you go listen to a preacher that you've heard some bad things about, maybe you've had a bad impression of, but maybe you don't really know him. Maybe he's holding a gospel meeting in the area. You ever had this experience? And you go listen to him, and you almost find yourself just looking for negative things. Have you ever put yourself in that mindset? Just be honest with yourself. And I'll just tell you, I have. You know, and sometimes if I can get myself out of that mindset, I'm surprised that, you know, in fact, what's been said about this individual is not really true and some things like that. But once that gets in your head that somebody is doing something wrong, that there's something wrong with this person, boy, it's really hard not to start looking for things. And so these Pharisees had really already got it firmly in their heads that Jesus was just doing some things that ought not to be done. And so on this occasion, that's all they can't see past, you know, their noses to see, hear anything he's saying, to see the value of any work that he's doing, the import of it. They can't fathom any of that because they're looking for something. And normally, if you're looking for something and you're so intent on that, you're going to find something that sort of fits the bill for you. And it kind of is a warning to us about, you know, hard-heartedness, closed-mindedness that goes along with hard-heartedness. I heard it first from Mary Faye Hedrick a number of years ago. I've heard other people say it since then. But, you know, you want to keep your mind open, just not so open that your brains fall out. I like that. But to keep your mind open is to keep your heart open. But you do have to be, you know, thoughtful about what you're open to. But these men were closed. They were looking for something. Jesus asked them, well, is it lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath day? Mark's account says, is it lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath day, to save a life or to kill? In Matthew's account, the issue comes up, what about a sheep? If you have a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, what's a Jew going to do if he loses a sheep in a pit on the Sabbath day? What's he going to do? He's going to get it out. He's going to rescue it. Okay? And no doubt, all sorts of work would be involved in that. But every Jew, Jesus says, basically, he implies there's not a man among them who wouldn't rescue his sheep on the Sabbath day. And the implication is, here's a human being, just like we saw with the woman in the account in Luke 13 that we read to begin with. Here's a human being. What's more valuable, a human being or an animal? Well, there'd be a lot of people today, the tree huggers, you know, who would say, well, an animal is more. In fact, I was watching a PBS show a couple of years ago, and it was about elephants. And there was an elephant hugger scientist lady on there that she just said that. My jaw just dropped. She was talking about poaching elephants, and she said, the lives of these elephants are so much more valuable than human lives. I just said, you've got to be kidding. But that's the mindset of a lot of people. But Jesus understands, and at least these Jews understood, that human life is more valuable than animal life. Much more so. And that's something that's not really understood very well in our society. But a sheep could be rescued. And if a sheep could be rescued, a human could be rescued, surely, either spiritually or physically. I thought I'd like to share some information with you about what Jews really believe concerning the Sabbath. The first quotation I have up there is from modern Orthodox Jews and what they would practice. The second and third quotations come from the Babylonian Talmud, which was is Jewish holy writing, quote unquote, of the scribes and the rabbis that was written down. Actually after the time of Christ, but a lot of these oral traditions existed in the time of Christ. So here's what they say. In modern times, it says, we are permitted to violate Shabbat, or Sabbath. They put the H in the wrong place, by the way. I don't know why Hebrews do that. We are permitted to violate Sabbath to a limited extent to rescue an animal in pain or at risk of death. For example, we can move them if they are in pain, move objects that we would not otherwise be permitted to touch to relieve their pain. We may give them medicine, and we may ask non-Jews to do things that would violate Sabbath to help a suffering animal. So that's basically the rule that they go by today and pretty well have over the centuries. This is stated in a couple of different ways in the ancient Talmud. The Talmud says, if circumcision, which concerns one of man's limbs, puts off the Sabbath to rescue a soul, puts off the Sabbath. In other words, they understood that circumcision could be done on the Sabbath if it fell on the eighth day of a male child's life. And so other things to rescue a soul could be also done on the Sabbath. That's not violating the Sabbath. And then the Talmud also says that if one prepared bundles of straw or stalks of greens before the Sabbath to feed one's animals on the Sabbath, they may be moved. But if not, they may not be moved. That's just you say, well, what's that saying? That says if you get your stuff together to feed your animals bundles of, you know, greens or whatever it is, as long as you prepare it before the Sabbath day, then you can pick that up and carry it out to feed your animals on the Sabbath day. So they even understand that some menial work, certainly carrying those bundles out to feed your animals, could be done on the Sabbath day. When we get back to Matthew 12, isn't their hypocrisy just sort of glowing now? You see how terribly hypocritical they were being. Condemning Jesus for things that in many other contexts they would allow and even go beyond, you know, what Jesus was doing. They were not looking for the truth. They were looking for something to find fault with. If you're not looking for the truth and you're looking for fault, you're going to find fault. So, when Jesus asked them the question, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day? They remained silent. Mark chapter 3 and verse 5, in Mark's record of this, Jesus looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the what? Hardness of their hearts. Yeah. It's grieved by the hardness of their hearts. A couple of things here. Anger is not a sin. Okay, it can easily lead to sin. Of course, Ephesians 4 tells us, be angry and sin not. So you can be angry without sinning. It's something where we put ourselves into a position to be tempted to sin pretty easily. But anger itself is not a sin. And there are times when it would be wrong not to be angry. Would you agree with that? There are things that we need to be angry about. And rebelliousness against God would be at the top of that list. We should just be bothered when people are hard-hearted, rebellious against our Heavenly Father. Jesus perceived that. Of course, Jesus was able to read these people's hearts. He really knew even beyond the things that we've studied, you know, He knew even deeper how hard their hearts really were. And it upset Him. He was angry. A lot of times today, you know, my experiences in teaching school, and listening to what some of the students say at times, if a teacher gets angry and expresses that justifiably, you know, because students are misbehaving or because something's happened or they're not living up to their potential or something like that, teacher gets angry and expresses that, then most students feel like, oh, that's just terrible, but, you know, we... Or some of them think it's great that we got their goat, you know, and got them to get mad and express it like that. But the point is, I think that perception of that I've seen a lot in young people is not correct. That just because, and sometimes I see it and hear it in older folks as well, just because somebody is angry and expresses that, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It may be a very good and appropriate thing. Same thing you see with political candidates, and which we're seeing a lot of lately. You know, if one of them kind of blows his top one day and goes off the reservation and gets mad and expresses it about, you know, how he's being treated in the media or something, then all of a sudden the media think they've exposed some flaw in this person. And in fact, it may be one of the greatest things about their character is that things that are wrong and bad make them angry. You know, so how the world sees this and the reality of it from the Lord's standpoint are two different things. So he's angry. He looks on them and their silence and their hard-heartedness. And yet you see all of that sort of under control. Obviously, he could have called lightning down from heaven, as we talked about in a sermon recently, done whatever he wanted to do, but that's not what he was about. What does hardness of heart lead to? In Romans chapter 2 and verse 5, Paul says, in accordance with your hardness and your impenitent heart. You're treasuring up for yourselves wrath in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. The more we harden our hearts, the more we refuse to allow God to change us. We're just like putting money in the bank of wrath. We are treasuring up wrath for ourselves. And that will all be given to us on the judgment day. Hebrews 3:8, do not harden your hearts as in the day of provocation in the wilderness. He goes on to say that the Israelites, they tested me. They saw my wrath as a result of that. Proverbs 28:14, he who hardens his heart will fall into calamity. So you have all of these warnings and many others in Scripture. Just don't be hard-hearted. Don't be so prejudiced against what's true, so close-minded against what the Scriptures say, that you can't change what you feel and believe as a consequence. Well, we finally get then to the point of the miracle itself. We've seen the attitude of the Pharisees, which really this miracle is designed to illustrate to us, but in verse 13 of Matthew 12, Jesus said to the man, stretch out your hand. The man stretches out his hand. Now, is there really work involved in that? And some of the things that miracles, like the man at the Pool of Bethesda we studied Wednesday night, he had to pick up his bed and walk by the command of Jesus. But you could see why some of the Jews might have objected to that if they didn't understand the divine nature of the miracle. But here, stretching out your hand, nobody would surely could say that was work. But the man was to stretch out his hand, and he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. Was there faith on the part of this man? Where is it exhibited? Stretching out his hand. If he just kept his hand down at his side and said, I don't believe I'm going to try that, it would have shown a lack of faith. Okay, but just being willing to do that, let's ask a further question. Did the man earn his healing by stretching out his hand? Well, don't you earn your baptism, your salvation by being baptized? Isn't that earned salvation? It's the same kind of thing, isn't it? It's just a little something Jesus asked you to do, an act of faith, so you can receive the blessing. You don't earn it. It's just a condition to receive the blessing. He had to stretch out his hand. So many of the miracles illustrate that same point. And as a consequence of it, the Pharisees and the Herodians are filled with rage, it says, one text says, that they're just angry. Anger has just eaten them up. Now, Jesus was angry. He controlled it. The Pharisees and the Herodians are just filled with rage. And so much so that they go out and plot how they might destroy Jesus. This is an interesting, someone has said that politics makes strange bedfellows. The Pharisees and the Herodians were not really theologically on the same page, but they had a common enemy, they thought, in Jesus Christ. And because of that, they united, and this is not the only time, there's several times in Scripture, actually when you get to the trial of Jesus, the Herodians are mentioned as being a part of that, along with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and you talk about three different parties at odds with one another of the Jews who were willing to all lay aside their differences to come together to kill Christ, basically. But you see, sometimes anger and hostility can do that, can it? We have a common enemy, and it doesn't matter, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, even if he's my enemy. So that's what you see. Well, quickly, here's some of the lessons that we learn. Having the right heart is more important to God than precisely following ritual and tradition. It's important to have both the law of God and the spirit of the law in our hearts. Secondly, we've seen that humans are more valuable than animals. Jesus can make the useless useful. Think about what that man said. Hard telling how long he hadn't been able to use that hand and just been useless to him. And now, He can use it. Personal bias can keep someone from perceiving obvious truth. We've said that several times. And then think about what makes God angry. Jesus was angry. Jesus is God. What makes God angry? Well, hard-heartedness does. And as far as a personal application goes, we need to ask ourselves, do I make God angry? Appreciate your attention and help this morning. Although y'all weren't quite as helpful as you have been being, you need to be more helpful to me. And we're going to study, Lord willing, the healing of the centurion's servant, lesson 11 on Wednesday night. Thank you for being part of the class.